As we continue our topical series tonight, I want to look at evolution's faith commitment. We know that there's no such thing as neutrality in any area of life. Any topic we look at, any subject that we look at, there's no such thing as neutrality. And we'll see tonight this practically unpacked with respect to those who embrace evolution, what their faith commitment actually is. Because ultimately, evolution's great missing link is between the actual facts and what they purport these facts to be. What they hold the facts out as, and what the facts actually are in and of themselves. Since Darwin's book, The Origin of the Species, which everybody calls it by, which is only a fraction of its title, its original title, I don't know if you know what it is, The Origin of the Species by Means of Natural Selection or the Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. Sounds like a racist statement, doesn't it? Favored races. This was first published in 1859. And since then, the theory of evolution has assumed the position of a big bully. As the historian Greg Singer has observed, Darwin became the order of the day. Scholarship, which did not pay due obeisance to this new deity, became suspect. The theory became thoroughly entrenched as a scientific fact, and its truths could not be questioned. Permeating every area of academic and intellectual endeavor, it became the frame of reference for the Western mind. And that's in John Whitehead's book, The End of Man, which I'll quote from quite a bit this evening. To many Christians, evolution seems like a terrifying ogre, and thus they would rather steer clear of the subject if they possibly can. But it needn't be like that. We feel intimidated. We feel science is against us. The whatever programs are put on and they quote their scientific evidence, it can be very intimidating. The promoters of evolution have been able to con and intimidate their opponents for a very long time by burying them with so-called scientific evidence. The evolutionist argument claims to have all the necessary scientific evidence supporting their view of the origin of the world, whereas those who speak about God and creation have only faith to support their view. That's the whole thing. You guys are in faith. We have the scientific evidence. We have all the proof. And we can back up our assertions with scientific details. Thus, the great modern debate is said to be a debate between scientific fact and religious faith. Or facts versus faith. The layperson evolutionist claims that the Christians have only faith, whereas they, on the other hand, have heaps and heaps of scientific evidence to support what they believe. Now, it's true they have lots of drawings and diagrams and charts and assumptions and complicated jargon, but this is nothing but a smokescreen designed to baffle the person on the street and to confuse the unsuspecting students. The reality, however, is that there are no facts to support their assumptions. They talk about the missing link as if there were just one piece of the puzzle left for them to find, yet in reality, what they need are billions of links or intermediary steps, and they are no closer today to finding even one of them than they were in Darwin's day. There's no such thing as the missing link. A missing thesis would be closer to the truth, certainly not a missing link. I think what they mean today when they talk about the missing link is that they would love to find just one of the billions of needed links to prove their theory, for that would at least give them one piece of evidence for their theory. Now, evolutionists have been desperate over the years to find a link, so much so that we all know the story of the human ape thing that was created out of a pig tooth, Nebraska man, or as Dr. Gish has said, this is a case in which a scientist made a man out of a pig, and the pig made a monkey out of the scientist. Dawn Man or Piltdown Man was another discovery that fooled the evolutionists for quite some time. It was thought to be a link, however, turned out to be a human skull and a monkey jaw, from which highly skilled paleontologists had created a whole person. The amazing thing is that the length of time it took the scientific world to realize that Piltdown Man was a fraud. And during that time, it is said that over 500 doctoral dissertations were written on this important link. So So these guys, 500 doctors, will receive their PhDs from writing a thesis on this, and the whole thing was bogus to start off with. Even if you get the better of an evolutionist in a discussion, they'll often say, well, all this seems unclear to us. However, those who make paleontology their life calling and really study all the facts and the evidence, they have the answers. Our gurus up there have the answers for the stuff. Those are the clever guys. I can't tie it all together here, but I'm confident those guys can. And most people believe the picture, charts, and the assumptions that are printed in textbooks in full color. And there's no doubt in the minds of all those that the needed scientific proof for their pictures and diagrams is actually available. The average man on the street who believes in evolution, who wholeheartedly trusts that the scientific evidence is inescapable, and if only the Christian would look at the facts, they too would believe in evolution. And they say that the Christian's childish faith gets in the way of scientific fact. And thus the debate, as far as most evolutionists are concerned, is this fact versus faith, the scientific observation versus this mindless leap of faith. And this is the case, or so they think it is. Now the truth is, you can spend a lot of time getting into the different arguments that evolutionists present, the different facts they throw at you to try and counter them, to try and refute them and bring counter evidence and stuff. And there's nothing wrong with that, but it takes a certain amount of specializing in dealing with that in order to counter their arguments. And it's a massive amount of research that is required. I want to show you another possible and quicker way to strike at the underbelly of the evolution system, and follow it up with a significant moral challenge. What we can easily do is expose the foolish idea held by most amateur evolutionists that evolution is scientific. We can pull the wheels off their foolish claim once and for all. Evolution does not rest upon scientific evidence, but rather upon a definite religious and philosophical foundation. It needs to be pointed out that evolution is fundamentally a religious position. It's a commitment of faith to this position. Darwin himself admitted this in a later edition of The Origin of the Species, which was edited by Valorium in the University Press, published in 1959, page 759. Darwin said, "There is grandeur in this view of life, having been originally breathed by the Creator into new forms." It's a quote from Darwin, printed in Whitehead's book, page 62, that I mentioned earlier. What I want to do is look at some of the leading evolutionists of our era, people who are regarded in the evolutionist camp as the leaders of the movement and who are respected as the great authorities on the subject. What do they say about all the supposed scientific evidence that supports their theory? How do they approach it? What do they believe about it? Colin Paterson, who was the senior paleontologist at the British Museum of Natural History in London, he said on July the 5th in 1981, in a speech to a group of experts on evolutionary theory at the American University of Natural History in New York, he said he was suddenly struck by a fearful realization. He said to this distinguished group of evolutionists, and I quote, "One morning I woke up and it struck me that I had been working on this stuff," meaning evolution, "for 20 years and there was not one thing I knew about it. That's quite a shock to learn that one can be misled for so long. So for the last few weeks, I've tried putting a simple question to various people or groups of people. Can you tell me anything you know about evolution? Any one thing that is true? All I got was silence. The absence of answers seems to suggest that evolution does not convey any knowledge, or if so, I haven't heard it yet. I think many people in this room would acknowledge that during the last few years, if you had thought about it at all, you have experienced a shift from evolution as knowledge to evolution as faith. I know that's true for me, and I think that it's true for a good many of you. Evolution not only conveys no knowledge, but seems somehow to convey anti-knowledge." So here at least he's acknowledging the truth, but here you've got, it's an incredible quote from someone whose life is given to proving evolution is true, and he's saying there is no knowledge in this. We have not one shred of evidence. One of the first things you learn as a kid in your science classes is how science disproved spontaneous generation. I can remember studying that as a kid. And that spontaneous generation is life spontaneously rises out of dead, decaying matter. Now you all see it. There's a dead creature sitting on the side of the road, and suddenly there's maggots. See, it just proves that from death comes life. And that was belief. But anyway, my science teacher showed me that wasn't true. We're told how people formerly believed that fruit flies came from banana peels and maggots from dung or rotting meat. Then through the experiments of Reddy in 1688 and Spallanzani in 1780 and Louis Pasteur in 1860, it was proven that life came only from pre-existing life. However, then later on in your science classes, as you got older and you became now more mature and accustomed to scientific thinking, then you were taught as an inescapable fact that spontaneous generation was the evolutionary mechanism by which life arose. It arose out of dead matter. And so, you know, you're kind of at that stage. If we were taught to think consistently, we would have seen the contradiction, but we weren't. And so the contradiction just flew over, for me anyway, most people's heads, and you continued, oh yeah, look at that, it came from nothing. Harold C. Urey, he was a Nobel laureate and famed evolutionist. He said, and I quote, "All of us who study the origin of life find that the more we look into it, the more we feel that it is too complex to have evolved anyway. We all believe, as an article of faith, that life evolved from dead matter on this planet. It is just that its complexity is so great, it is hard for us to imagine that it did." Okay, it's a matter of fact that it evolved. We know it can't, but it's too complex for us to realize, but we know it did. Princeton University physicist astronomer Carl Sagan, who is the unofficial high priest of evolution, said, and I quote, "Today, it is far easier to believe that organisms arose spontaneously on the Earth than to try to account for them in any other way. Nevertheless, this still is a statement of faith rather than of demonstrable scientific fact. Scientists have only sketchy notions of how this evolution might have occurred." So now these people know that they are playing games with the public. Because Sagan says, in order for science to be called science, the experiments must be reproducible. We can't reproduce it. This is a scientific fact, how life came about. We can't reproduce it, but this is scientific. What you believe over there, Christian, is faith, and that's unscientific. So they play games with our minds, and we buy into that, and we're intimidated by it. And that is the mindset of the world that we live in. Bearing in mind what has just been said, Sagan says things like, "Evolution is no longer a theory but a proven fact." So you'll say that in another place. "The cosmos is all that is or ever was or ever will be." That's the fact. That's the scientific fact. Physicist and evolutionist Robert Jastrow said, "Either life was created on the Earth by the will of a being outside the group of scientific understanding, or it evolved on our planet spontaneously through the chemical reactions occurring in the non-living matter lying on the surface of the planet. The first theory is a statement of faith in the power of a supreme being, not subject to the law of science. The second theory is also an act of faith. The act of faith consists in assuming that the scientific view is correct without having concrete evidence to support that belief." So his use of scientific view is subtle. How can it be called a scientific view if there's no concrete evidence to support his view? But he still calls it a scientific view. This is the scientific view. This is the view of faith. George Wild, who was a biologist at Harvard University and also won a Nobel Prize for Science, said, and I quote, "One only has to contemplate the magnitude of the task to concede that the spontaneous generation of living organism is impossible. Yet here we are, as a result, I believe, of spontaneous generation." Wald also said, "When it comes to the origin of life on the Earth, there are only two possibilities, creation or spontaneous generation. There is no third way. Spontaneous generation was disproved 100 years ago, but that leads us only to one other conclusion, that of supernatural creation. We cannot accept that on philosophical grounds. Therefore, we choose to believe the impossible, that life arose spontaneously by chance." They're not even subtle. It's absolute blatant that this is the foundation of what our 21st century believes. This is the heavyweights who are speaking and laying the foundation and the platform upon which every aspect of our life rests today. DNA is a molecule that contains the coded hereditary information from every cell in our bodies, and it exists inside the nucleus of every minute body cell. We are told that each strand of DNA is about 6.5 feet long, and that if you stretched out and joined together all the DNA in one person's body, it would reach to the moon and back. You know, there's obviously a lot of repeat in that. You know, the DNA is not... Each body cell is incredibly small, yet DNA resides in only a small part of these minute body cells. Yet despite its size, the information code stored in a DNA molecule could fill 1,000 books, each containing 500 pages of very small, closely printed type. Actually, DNA information is so compactly stored that the amount of DNA necessary to code all the people living on our planet might fit into a space no larger than an aspirin tablet. That's how compact it is, but that's, you've got to understand how much information is in such a compact place. Darwin's theory of evolution was based upon the assumption that the simple body cell really was simple. That was his foundation. The body is very simple, the cell is. Yet the more scientists investigate the human cell, the more complex they realize it is. Actually, each single cell in our body is so complex that one evolutionary scientist said that any machine man has made or ever will make will never compare with it in complexity. The genetic information contained in each microscopic body cell is roughly equivalent to a library of 4,000 volumes. The average human body comprises 30 trillion cells. Thus, to picture how much information is stored in one human body, we have to picture a library containing how many books? 4,000 multiplied by 30 trillion. That's 120 followed by 15 zeros. I think it's 120 zillion in American, which is what the dollar's going to be in 6 years' time. The scientist, Dr. Francis Crick, is a Nobel Prize winner and credited with co-discovering DNA. Dr. Crick, who is by no means a Christian, in working out the probabilities of a single molecule of DNA coming into existence by chance, concluded that there was absolutely no chance of a single molecule of DNA coming into existence by chance. Two world-renowned scientists and mathematicians, Fred Hoyle and Chandra Wickramasinghe, worked together to calculate the number of years for just one simple cell to come into existence by chance. Now, Wickramasinghe has also written 24 books about astrophysics. So he's a sharp and bright man, but he's not a Christian. And they're calculating how many years would be needed for a cell to come into existence by itself. And these men concluded that the number of years needed for one simple cell to come into existence by chance would be 10 to the power of 40,000. That's 10 followed by 40,000 zeros. Scientists usually say that if the probability of something is 10 to the power of 50, that's 10 with 50 zeros, it's an impossibility. And this is a 10 to 40,000 zeros. Try and put some concept to those kinds of numbers. The evolutionist says that the Earth is probably 30 billion years old. So, Sal, how many seconds does that mean it is? Okay, that's 10 followed by 18 zeros. Small number compared to what we're talking about here. How many seconds make up 30 billion years? And are we talking about 10 followed by 40,000 zeros? Dr. Carrick said the chance, it's as big as of such numbers, that he said that the chance that the first life could have spontaneously generated from Earth's chemistry was zero. However, it's Dr. Carrick, his solution, it's impossible that life could have evolved like that. His solution to this dilemma, because he believes in evolution, a life cell was brought from outside our solar system and deposited. What we got here? We've got an infinite regress. Has he explained the origin of life? No. He's just taken a shortcut. And people, oh, that's what happened. That convinces me. Do you realize that science itself, we've done apologetics before in our courses here, but science itself is impossible upon the concept of a chance time universe where this randomness. Science falls away. The scientists cease to exist. You cannot do science based on that principle, that the world is in constant flux and changing. The issue is explained by Thomas H. Huxley, who was one of the fiercest defenders of Darwin's theory of evolution when it was first published in 1859. So fierce that he coined the nickname, people called him, Darwin's bulldog. So they'd get him to get onto you if you were resisting Darwin, kind of thing. Huxley tells us why he jumped at Darwin like he did. He refused to submit to the authority of God, and thus he wanted something to put in its place, no matter what that something was. He didn't care where that road went, just as long as it was an alternative route. He was very open about his personal presuppositions and prejudices, admitting that he didn't want to follow the Creator's route, though realized that if his own approach to science was going to be followed, he had to destroy Moses. He said that. He was, I know what I've got to do. I've got to get rid of this guy, this creation, this story of God and what has happened. The evolutionist, neo-Orthodox theologian, Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, I don't know if you said Chardin, I don't know how to pronounce his name properly. He said that even if all the evidence pointing towards evolution were demolished, evolution would still have to be man's fundamental vision. The reason for this was because evolution had long since ceased to be a hypothesis and had become a general epistemological condition. Epistemology, remember, is your theory of knowledge, how I know that I know. When evolution becomes your epistemology, that is the basis for you knowing anything. He confessed his faith in evolution as the light illuminating all facts, a curve that all lines must follow. Okay, so here's evolution's curve. That's how it turns, whatever that curve, how you're going to make it, you can do it like that if you want. But every idea, every thought, everything that comes into your mind, every evaluation you make, every piece of discussion you have, has to follow that curve no matter what. Nothing can go against that curve that evolution has set. So everything you see, everything you interpret, everything you try and project upon the world follows that curve exactly. That's what he's saying. That's the foundation, that's the presupposition for life. The theory of evolution is merely an attempt by man to give some kind of intellectual support to his rebellion against the truth of God. At the end of the day, those who have specialized in the field of evolution know that there is no scientific proof to support their theory, but they continue to hold to it by blind faith. And the reason they do that is because they refuse to repent of their rebellion against God, and so the only alternative is self-deception. They give themselves up to believe the lie. And then they shape their world in terms of that. We must not be fooled or intimidated into believing that evolution has all the scientific proof, whereas Christianity only has faith. Both Christianity and evolution are positions of faith or rest upon faith commitments. We are committed to a certain thing, to a certain body of truth that we believe to be substantial. The important question to ask is, which one supplies the necessary foundations whereby faith in this world is possible? Whereby life and living and exercising our being in this world. What supplies what is necessary? Does the Christian religion, or does what evolution presents as a foundation in order to interpret life, in order to give purpose and meaning and direction to life? Which one supplies a basis for truth and justice, and which one provides a basis for making sense out of anything in this life? Yet the evolutionary mindset is the assumed foundation upon which education, government, morality, ethics, everything in this life now rests firmly and securely on that. And everything launches off that basis. To challenge that basis is heresy in our day. You are a heretic to challenge that basis. In our schools, they have completely eradicated the possibility of even mentioning the name of Christ, an evolutionist taught. That's the foundation of their thinking, it's the foundation of their morality and their ethics. And they communicate that to generation after generation. The ideas of ethics and life and justice all rest upon a lie. They know it to be a lie, and yet they present it as the foundation for morality and ethics. And they attempt to create civilization on that basis. So I hope that gives you at least confidence in yourself. I mean, I'm sure you weren't threatened by evolution historically, but at least gives you a foundation and a basis that you don't need to get sidetracked into all the minute details. If you get a couple of these quotes under your belt, or just even use it in a general sense, you say, you go and look up Carl Sagan and Huxley and Peterson and these guys said, and they themselves, who are your superiors, have arrived at these conclusions. But then also realize that upon that, when you say that and you realize that, that there is no neutrality. Too many in the church today continue to live as though there is such a thing as neutrality in life. We can think about the public school as being neutral. We can think that it's giving an education that is a body of truth that can sustain somebody for living, that can give them true information and knowledge. When in fact, their very foundation is at war with God. So does anybody want to add to that, or are there any questions?